1. Learning to fly. In the 1920s, when Jack was a child, a framed photograph of his father stood in the living room of their house on Richmond Avenue in South Orange, New Jersey. My grandfather, Edmund Vincent Lawler, had come to the United States in the early years of the 20th century, when he was barely in his teens. On September 19, 1916, he became a U.S. citizen. Not long after, he signed up for Officers' Candidate School at Princeton and got ready to join thousands of others in the World War, later renamed World War I. The picture on the table shows him in uniform, stiff with duty. As a household decoration, it signaled the deep connection between the nation and the family, demonstrated through military service. Papa, as we called our grandfather, gives a faint smile in the picture. There's nothing macho in his expression, no hint he was imagining himself heroic. He was a devout Catholic and would have understood his soldierly commitment as God's will. Fighting on the side of the Yanks also gave him a chance to show his affection for America. This was the country that had taken him in, given him a job in a powder factory, offered a new life to his mother and aunt. World War I was still a pulsating memory when Jack was a boy. For him, it would have been a murky tale of faraway places and mysterious danger. The photo showed his father on the edge of all this, an adventurer and a stunningly different person from the cheerful, gray-suited insurance salesman who came home every day at 6 o'clock. Edmund never went to war. It ended by the time he finished OCS. But I remember that picture of him in uniform, there in the many living rooms of my own early years, a reminder that Papa was not only the mild, affable Irishman we loved, but a man who knew how to use a gun, had been ready to expose himself to violence on behalf of our country. I say Papa smiles in the photo, but when I look at it now, the expression isn't so easy to read. The face is actually pretty blank. You could say it's a mask, an empty screen hiding Papa's feelings, even his sense of himself as a Navy ensign. The eyes are aimed slightly to the right, off camera, as if he's not entirely engaged in the portrait. If you keep looking, movement stirs in his face. It's in the eyes of the beholder, of course, but he begins to look like he's ready for something else and can barely stand the still pose. Is this simply his characteristic lack of vanity? Does he want to get going with the soldiering? Or is he itching to get out of the uniform, go home where he belongs? As Jack came to the end of his school years, the laughing family and shady streets of South Orange started to look tame. He tried a few semesters at Seton Hall University, not far from home, but his performance was less than impressive. Letters show he was already captured by thoughts of himself far away, across the continent, perhaps the ocean. But he never looked down on his local New Jersey world. It was the setting of boyhood stories he told us when we were kids. It was the place he gladly returned to after hot summer days in downtown New York working as a messenger for the Japanese Cotton and Silk Trading Company. South Orange was his mother's world. It was where Nan Ferris Lawler presided over his beloved brothers and sisters, my kin, as he jokingly called them. In his first uniform, standing on the dappled lawn of the house on Richmond Avenue, he grins at the camera, his arm around her. He looks happy to be so grounded there and so ready to go away. He wanted adventure. He wanted to go to sea, to learn navigation. He wanted to fly. In March 1942, Jack enrolled as a cadet at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. Established by Congress in 1938, the Merchant Marine Cadet Corps trained sailors for commercial ships that could convert to military service in times of war. Now, with the demands of World War II pressing, Merchant Marines were needed for duty in less time than the formal curriculum allowed. Jack spent 3 months in the classroom at the Academy Temporary Facilities on the Chrysler Estate in Great Neck, Long Island. Courses included seamanship, cargo handling, maritime engineering math, and ship construction. He studied hard and did well. Letters home, written in an exuberant voice, show how excited he was to be learning the life of a seaman, getting ready to see the world. In preparing for a naval science exam in the spring of 1943, he wrote his father, "If I don't pass it, at least I tried. I know you'll be interested to hear this, Dad, knowing how disappointed you were with the time I wasted in Seton Hall. I realize that myself now, Dad, more than ever, and I'm going to do my best to make up for it." He was affectionate with his parents and wrote as if pleasing them mattered a great deal. For all his desire to get away from home and out into the world, his identification with the family was absolute. Gleeful at what the merchant marines were preparing him to do, Jack found talents he didn't know he had in the seamanship training, especially in navigation. For the signaling course, he had to commit endless codes to memory. He would have to pass a test that required sending 8 words per minute in semaphore and another 8 in Morse. "It's going to be tough," he complained, "because there is nothing interesting about it. It's just plain memory work. But you've got to know this stuff on board ship, so it's a good thing." Practicing as an able-bodied seaman was another story. "Yesterday afternoon, we shipped an 800-pound anchor over the side to a barge, and there were only 3 of us to move it. Today we had quite a thrill. They sent Tex and me aloft to paint the masts on a boatswain swing. Boy, oh boy, but you're way up when you do that. And when we painted the top part and got down to the spar, we had to crawl out on our bellies to paint the end of the thing. God, I like to die. This mast was swaying with the ship and me out on the yard that was bending under my weight. I'm so darn tired from hanging on that, I can hardly lift the pin. But I think I'll live." With his 6-foot frame, good looks, and rough amiability, Jack made friends easily. Time with his new pals was often brief, as the advanced pace of merchant marine training meant assignments were given out quickly. In letters home, he complained of having to say goodbye. "I made quite a friend with this guy Tex, but he's due to go home in 2 weeks. Gosh, it's lousy, this way your friends come and go so quickly in a place like this." As Jack's first voyage approached, he was glum about the separations. "There are only 4 of us left out of our whole gang since this afternoon, for 3 shipped out then. Boy, it really seemed tough saying goodbye to those 3 guys this afternoon, and we're a pretty lonesome bunch tonight." The letter has a prophetic tone to it. There would be a lot of this in years to come. Jack would soon toughen up, learn to slap the guys on the back and say goodbye fast. He knew he might never see them again, and he stopped writing home about it. Reading this letter about the 3 guys shipping out so many decades later, I feel badly for my dad. Then I see mornings on the tarmac when Jack is leaving us for some long-term mission, and the sight of a neighborhood comes up, receding in the back window of our car. Friends, then boyfriends, wave goodbye. Of course, for Dad and his remaining pals, another kind of loss lurked at the sight of the waiting sea bags and in the last terse goodbyes. Where they were going, death lurked right beside the adventures. On May 11, 1942, he got his shipping papers. Rumors had been circulating that his cohort would have their first orders soon. Jack's letters were ambivalent about it. Twice he uses the word terrific, where terrible should be. A few paragraphs after announcing the news of the shipping papers, he writes, "It seems terrific to think that I'll be actually leaving home for such a long time. I keep trying to picture what it's going to be like. I just dread the thought of the damn last day when I have to say so long to you all." A week later, he and his pals set out by train for San Francisco, where they would be assigned to a ship. In the club car with his friend Ray Barrett, he penned a note posted by the porter from Pittsburgh, describing his sad self in not entirely convincing terms. "Well, that dreadful day when I had to leave you is almost past, And let me tell you, the big tough guy who never got homesick isn't so big and tough anymore. And this afternoon at Penn State, he was plenty homesick. But after we fastened up, we had a good chicken dinner for $1.65, less 10% for the uniform. I felt much better. But it was terrific leaving you. In San Francisco, before reporting for ship duty, he had the time of his life. He and his friends were treated like visiting celebrities. I'm in the best place in town, the Hotel Francis Drake, and a gal just took my picture. I'll send you one. In the same letter, he tells them, our picture was in the SF Chronicle. I'll send you one of those, too. The SF Chamber of Commerce is having a National Maritime Day, and we were picked to pose for the paper. He sent a clipping along, a photo of himself and a fellow cadet in dress uniform, smiling as they explained the details of a model cargo ship bridge to a San Franciscan named Virginia Haley. It's hard to tell whether the center of the photo is the ship model, Dad's grin, or Haley's legs. At the Persian Room on May 21st, he laughs at the camera in the company of an unnamed actress in a white pillbox hat. The next night, at Charlie Lowe's Forbidden City, a supper club on Sutter Street, he stands beside a local actress, looking awkward but dapper nonetheless. Another night in the Persian Room, Jack glances at the photographer while talking with Ray Barrett and another friend from the Academy. Over cocktails and smokes, they're obviously enjoying themselves. But something serious hovers between them. Ray wrote on the inside of the photo sleeve, we went to the Academy together, and now we're going to sea together. Need I say more than all the luck in the world to you? Amid the dancing and cocktails and the photographers, they were having a ball. They were also thinking about what was coming next. He was assigned to the Grace Line's Santa Clara. The ship is a corker. It's big, fast, and well-armed. Thank God, he wrote to the family. Our stateroom was a mess when we first got into it, but today we fixed it up and it's pretty nice. We have plenty of room, our own bath, and lots of closet and locker space. There are three of us in the room, and we get along swell. The meals are swell, and we eat in the officer's mess. It's a break being on a troop ship, because the food is always extra good on them, and besides, they are all well protected. Earlier, still in San Francisco, he had met some of his superiors and written home. The officers are swell guys and surprisingly young. We are with the third mate tonight, and the girls, Jack's sisters, Anne and Marge, would go nuts over him. We are learning more than I thought it was possible for me to commit to my thick cranium, just through these young fellers. The skipper is only 35. How about that? In 10 weeks, they would be back in New York. Jack was out of his head with excitement, but mindful of his attachment to home. In a postscript, he notes, I'm damn happy, but a little lonesome. By the end of his first year, Jack had been at sea for 9 months. Still, he kept in touch with South Orange regularly. He addresses the household as Dear Home and signs his letters Salty. Expressions of affection intensify as time, distance grow. On the eve of his first trip to the Pacific, he wrote, You have said you were proud of me. Well, I'm pretty damn proud to call myself one of you. At times, the words have a fainting ring of guilt for being so far from home, for having a great time at it. You are the grandest mother and dad a fellow could have, and I'll always look forward to the days I can spend with you again. Jack was out on a cruise when Edward Howe, who would soon become his close friend and brother-in-law, entered the Merchant Marine Academy in 1943. 5 years later, Ed married Franny's younger sister, Mary Ellen. Like a mirror opposite of our family, Mary Ellen and Ed had 4 sons, more or less our ages. Much later, after my dad and uncle had become experienced seamen and pilots, after they'd seen violent action in war, it was the Howe boys who learned about the most dramatic events, the violent ones. As girls and even women, we were never told those things, Bits and pieces reached our ears, fragments of stories about crashes and escapes through enemy territory. We would wonder, mystified about where our father had been, how these things happened, what he felt and did. I imagined veiled scenes in dark jungles, Dad slipping through the high growth, his terrified gaze hunting the perimeter. He would be operating on deadly survival instincts, hungry, thirsty, wet. A specter as frightening as the enemies who missed him, he crept in absolute silence, the blue eyes like flashlights pointing the way. Or he was down in the sea, clinging to the wing of a plane, waiting for some helicopter to lift him out. These images came and went, whether he was home or away. During the return cruise to New York in early August, Jack's exhilaration with life as a merchant marine came under the cloud of one difficult commander. I remember him telling me the man threw his weight around, made his presence felt among the cadets, making them do unnecessary things, just because he could. Jack got in his sights and found himself in a power struggle with a personal charge to it. He restrained himself from telling the guy off when he demanded that a course, checked for accuracy several times already, be backed up with a series of alternative routes, a job that called for meticulous, time-consuming calculations. Jack took a deep breath and performed the useless tasks, but swore he would get out of this man's clutches. Landed in New York again in September, he and his buddies proceeded to the Merchant Marine office downtown to sign up for another trip out. But the functionary in charge refused to put them together on a different ship. Word had made its way from the dock. Jack and his best friend, George Roper, decided to hell with them. As Merchant Marine cadets, they had already been sworn into the Navy on reserve status. The Navy could give them something the Academy couldn't. They could learn to fly. The next day, the two of them walked north to the Naval Recruiting Office and enlisted for active duty. In the Merchant Marines, the cadets had been introduced to the ancient discipline of navigation. Always good at math in school, Jack, George, and my Uncle Ed had taken it up like naturals. Mathematical representations were as real to them as the ground itself. Even in retirement, their desks were littered with compasses, rulers, pencils, and scraps of paper covered with calculations. The practice of charting seas gave them confidence in moving through watery space, like it was lined and readable as a series of roads. Success at plotting a course at sea, as Uncle Ed explained not long ago, rattled their imaginations. They wondered how it would be to navigate the sky. In the autumn of 1942, Jack and George began flight school at the Naval Air Station in New Paltz, New York, north of West Point. Ed came up the following year. Jack's notes for the first course, in a folder labeled in block print, Aircraft Identification, Mr. Oakley, shows he was already dedicated to learning everything he could about airplanes. In a careful hand, he lists four main wing and plane relationships, wing descriptions, and tips. He copies the markings for Navy and Army aircraft alphabetically. A hand-drawn graph, the boxes neatly ruled, identifies the names of airplanes with their wing and tip configurations, engine and armaments, tail and fuselage surfaces, speed, ceiling and load range. 42 different planes appear in the 6-page chart. Photos cut from catalogs and neatly taped to the notebook pages show the Grumman G-21 and the F-4F Wildcat, the Martin PBM-3 Mariner, a flying boat, the Vought Sikorsky, OS-2U-1 Kingfisher, the SB-2U-3 Vindicator, a dive bomber, and many others. British airplanes appear, the Hawker Hurricane 2C, with bombs slung under the wings, and the Handley Page Halifax. A page is set aside for Japan's Kawanishi Type 94, a bomber for which no information is available on the location of the bomb bays. Another for Germany's Dornier DO-17, a reconnaissance bomber, and the infamous Messerschmitts. the ME-110 and the ME-109F. Captions indicate the wing and tail markings and the all-important size, speed, and range specifications. For survival's sake, Jack would have to get these in his head. Notes in the margins indicate he was memorizing speed, altitude, and bombing capabilities of all the aircraft. In March 1943, he wrote his father, "I've got almost 4 hours in the air now, and I ought to solo in 7 or 8, which should be sometime this week. I've got a damn good instructor, and he drums those fundamentals into us all the time. I'm due to go upstairs to learn a series of spins." Upstairs referred to 4,000 feet, a dramatic new level. The excitement of flying so high, of getting to take the airplane to the limits of its capacity, continues a few days later. "Boy, those spins are something. We climbed to 4,000, cut the motor, and turned her nose straight up and put the rudder hard left and bingo! Down she goes, nose first, spinning like a top. We do 2 complete spins and come out of it." Shortly after, he made his first solo. The plane was an Aronca Defender. He told his brother Edmund about it later, but no description of this prime moment appears in the letters. Soon he sent his mother an account of what flying alone was like. "Walt, my instructor, let me go out over our area alone yesterday afternoon for a whole hour. You can't see the area from the field, so I had quite a time for myself. First, I practiced high work and went up over the cloud bank at about 7,000 feet. You never saw anything so beautiful in all your life. Just you, the plane, and the sky and those big white pillows below you. Super stuff." Already he felt confident enough with the aircraft to start fooling around. "After that, I went down very low and practiced forced landings and made sure the fields were pastures, and boy, you ought to see those damn old cows run. When I realized how much fun it was, I tried dive bombing them, and hot dog if Bossy didn't damn near give birth to a goat. Oh, you should have seen them go." He signs the letter, "Orville Wright." Training continued into the summer of 1943 at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where he started doing aerobatic hops, then at Bunker Hill, Indiana, where his enthusiasm grew explosive. "The flying is really terrific," he wrote his mother and father. "There are 3 stages you have to get through. First, you have A stage. That's just safe for solo, and then B stage. That's S-turns and slips to circles and wing over. Then in C stage, you really start flying. That's aerobatics and night flying, and those aerobatics include everything. Slow rolls, snap rolls, amelmans, and inverted spins and falling leaves, and every other tough one you can think of." During those months at Chapel Hill, Jack went through a rigorous athletic program, including a week each of track, swimming, football, and boxing. The cadets were graded for each sport. Competition for strong marks was high. On August 5th, he wrote his parents, "I got my boxing marks yesterday and today. I didn't make out too good yesterday. I lost my fight, but today I made up for it. I won by a TKO. That means they had to stop the fight because the guy I was fighting was badly cut up." Without another word about this, he moves on to his success in football. He had made the battalion squad, a first for his platoon. His father must have written expressing concern about the August 5th account of leaving his boxing opponent pretty badly cut up. On the 31st, Jack wrote, "You sounded a little worried about my reaction to that fight I had. Well, it's okay. Fact is, I've made pretty good friends with the guy since, and he wasn't hurt too much anyway." This is the first evidence of Jack's capacity for combat. The athletic schedule at Chapel Hill was aimed at sharpening reflexes for just this purpose. In late August, he described to his mother how wrestling was simultaneously training in hand-to-hand combat. "This hand-to-hand is the coldest stuff man ever thought up. It was explained to us this morning as the ways of quickly killing or disabling permanently a man with only weapons God gave us. We're being taught to gouge out a man's eyes and bite off his ears, and bite into his jugular vein in his throat, and every conceivable dirty stunt in the books. If the dirty stunts seemed repellent to Jack and the detailed description a way of absorbing the shock, they must have been nothing short of shocking to his mother. Why he would submit this information to her is something of a mystery. Sharing scenes of violence with women was not a practice he would continue. During these years as a young flyer, everybody in the family served in the crucial role of audience for his adventures. Jack's preferred vision of military life at this point was far and away a vision of flying, of trying out the heights and lows, the angles and spins an airplane could take. Ground combat was distasteful and not for him. In June 1944, he earned his wings at the Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida. At this point, a cadet could choose to continue with the Navy or to shift to the Marine Corps. And Jack chose the Marines. That fall, he found himself on the West Coast again, this time in Southern California. At the Marine Corps Air Station in El Toro, he underwent a combat conditioning course.
"You would think we were going through infantry school instead of being aviators. It's very much similar to Chapel Hill, only a lot tougher. We start at the crack of dawn and do close order drill, exercises, and bayonet drill until sundown. And then to bed, and no kidding, I'm there by 7. It's doing good, I guess." At El Toro meant more flight school, too. By now, he was tired of being a student. "Well, here we are again," he wrote in early January of 1945. "Back in school. How do you like it? Gee, I haven't done a damn thing but go to school since the beginning of the damn war. But this time I think I've got something because these jokers say that they are going to teach us how to fly every airplane the Navy uses. From primary trainers to the big four engine flying boats. This month alone we will be flying Avengers, Hellcats, Helldivers." He had been through 72 weeks of flight training, almost a year and a half as a student. As a professional aviator, he would go back to school periodically to learn the technology of new aircraft. Later training, however, was more about refining skills he already had, skills that would eventually come to be recognized as those of a master aviator. Jack had been away from home for some time now. He wrote that he missed the holidays with the family. "I don't expect we'll get a transcontinental for a couple of months yet, but I'll get there, by gosh. If they won't send me overseas, I'll get there by hook or crook." Aware of the ambivalence in his phrasing and the muddiness, won't instead of don't, and the open-ended meaning of there, about what he really wanted next, to go home or overseas, which meant to the war. He adds in parentheses, "To New York, I mean." In spite of Jack's exhaustion with being a student, it's pretty clear as he virtually chants the names of the airplanes he is about to get his hands on that what he wants most is to fly and fly some more. The implication is strong that he wanted not so much to go home, but to get further away. In all Jack's letters written from the Merchant Marine Academy, from Navy Flight School, and Marine Corps training, references to the Catholic religion in which he was raised are sparse and formal. From Navy Pre-Flight School in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in September 1943, he described a field mass he attended at the base stadium. It was a solemn high pontifical mass.
"Very pretty and very impressive. I sang in the choir, and we sang the Mass of St. Basil, and it sounded pretty good."
But the event is also memorable because his girlfriend Ruth was visiting from New Jersey. They'd been engaged since before he'd left the Merchant Marines, but the relationship wouldn't survive the long separation to come. Later that month, the base chaplain, Father Sullivan, asked Jack to manage a fundraising campaign with his outgoing battalion for the construction of a church. Jack spent a week with a friend giving pep talks and canvassing. The priest almost jumped out of his pants when they handed over $444.60. Other stories sent home remind his parents that he's still a good, practicing Catholic son, but none of his writing expresses a deep or conscientious sense of devotion. In a postscript, he notes,
"The chaplain is a grand guy. have been to sacraments, and still taking pills and saying Hail Marys. If pressed, Jack would undoubtedly have declared the whole project in which he was engaged, learning to be a warrior for the good guys, the deepest sacred duty he could perform. It was the sort of credo he would maintain throughout his military career. God, Christ, and the Virgin seemed to loom for him in a distant sphere. Signs of their benevolence or wrath might be legible in this world phenomena, but they existed elsewhere. Although he kept an image of Our Lady of Loreto, patroness of aviators, in the cockpit with him, it wasn't until after retirement that he showed a personal, more intimate connection with Catholicism. Maybe it was there in him earlier, but the letters suggest that for the young pilot, the more abstract, the more formal his religion, the better it would work for him. In May of 1945, he finally set out for the war to the site of one of the bloodiest conflicts, Okinawa. Assigned to Marine Fighter Squadron 222 of the 2nd Marine Air Wing, he left San Diego on a troop transport. He had been waiting for this, for the chance to get beyond the dress rehearsals of training to the sights of real action. Excitement beat like a drum. He knew, of course, that horror lay ahead. The terror was fuel already sharpening his senses. The well-ordered life at sea, like the round of days on the base, held up a steady, familiar world. The repetition of chores, drills, and meals flattened shipboard experience. Behind the lulling rhythms, however, an eerie, Melvillian spell dragged on. One hot day near New Guinea, when they couldn't take looking at the gunmetal and the horizon anymore, Jack and a few others climbed over the edge for a swim. Shortly after, the voice of the commander boomed from the deck, ordering them back on board. Reluctantly but quickly, they did as he said. The officer walked them across the deck to the opposite side of the ship and pointed into the water. It was boiling with hammerhead sharks. A shark shooter, as Uncle Ed Howe told me, would normally be stationed at a lookout point high above the deck when sailors were swimming in Pacific waters. Protecting the vulnerable crew, the shooter kept a close eye off the gunwales, ready to fire at any moment. If this protection was in place, it didn't dispel the commander's terror at sight of the enormous T-shaped fish thronging too close to the splashing men. The hammerhead shark story was in our heads, told more than once. So vivid was it in Dad's memory. He was a good storyteller. He knew how to pace the action, when to pause, when to raise and lower his voice. Making a collective character of the swimmers, he showed with wide eyes and eager shoulders how dangerously naive they were. The commander, deep-voiced and rigid, was right, he told us, not because the hammerheads proved him to be, but because he was the commander. With loose-minded people like his younger self to teach and supervise, the commander had to convey that his word, his order, was reason in itself. Jack's heart was not revolting now, as it had to the arbitrary power of the merchant marine officer in the summer of 1942. He had grown up, become a professional, and the wartime context demanded that everybody do precisely as they were told. The scene looks ominously symbolic of the enemy waiting over the horizon, a threat that hadn't crossed the threshold of visibility for Jack quite yet. But to our ears as children, the episode was like an allegory of the horrible things that could happen if you chose not to follow your leaders, whether they were parents or teachers or ship commanders. Outside the boundaries of our ruled lives, nature and the world's violent passions come snapping at your heels. Better to stay on the boat, as Chef repeats in Apocalypse Now, his voice mechanical, dehumanized with fear. In all those years of sailing, flying, fighting, and bombing far from home, pitched against nature and other people, was my father on the boat or off it? Following orders, he kept his place. He knew to stay near the boat and climb back aboard when commanded. But in later years, he would often have to operate as an irregular, out of anybody's reach, untraceable, courting danger. In this sense, he seemed regularly off the boat,
and that meant he was unreachable for us, at home, too. Being off the boat was at some level a choice for Jack, like it was for Captain Willard, just returned to Vietnam at the beginning of Apocalypse Now, describing his feelings about home. "When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle." VMF-222 would be credited with shooting down 53 Japanese planes during the Battle of Okinawa. Jack flew the F-4U Corsair, a carrier-based fighter aircraft he'd been trained to operate at El Toro. The Corsair was armed with Browning machine guns on the wings. It could shoot missiles and drop bombs. The Battle of Okinawa lasted for 3 months, until May 1945. At this point, the U.S. forces had established bases to be used as launch sites for a major attack on the Japanese mainland. The plan was scrapped, of course, when the atom bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But the bases remained in place. Jack and his fellow pilots lived in improvised quarters, tents, and later Quonset huts, not far from the airfield of Awase. From February until May 1946, the war now over, Jack was assigned to special service with the 4th Marine Wing. This meant duty in northern China. Among Dad's medals is a long yellow bar with a red stripe at each end, the China Service Medal. Marines had been posted to China since September 1945, helping accept the surrender of Japanese forces. The situation was complicated by the civil war that was building between Chiang Kai-shek's central government and the expanding communist movement under Mao Zedong. Stalin, still America's ally, was supporting Mao. The United States hadn't taken an overt military position in this struggle, although the hope was that Chiang would prevail. For ordinary Marines on duty in China, the scene was sometimes difficult to read. Jack was housed in U.S. facilities in Tsingtao, on the coast southeast of Beijing. He and other Marines shared a rough quarters with foreign nationals posted on commercial and diplomatic missions since before the war, and with members of the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. The UNRR was formed in 1943 by Roosevelt. The United Nations were the World War II allies. The mission was to provide economic aid and relief for nations damaged in World War II. In the international community in Tsingtao, Jack met a Russian woman named Vlada. He went out with her a few times, but decided to stop seeing her. One night, Vlada came knocking at his BOQ door. He didn't answer. She knocked louder and shouted into the night, "It is I, Vlada." He still didn't answer. Eventually, she went away. As Dad told the story, it was clear he thought it was funny. He did a comic imitation of Vlada's accent and her dramatic tone. It's hard to know if he was laughing at the time. My sisters and I never thought to ask this question. Were her antics laughable? Had he distanced himself from her because she was demanding or too serious about him? Had dating a Soviet citizen become a problem for American military personnel? Did Vlada's foreignness mean he didn't need to take her seriously, whether she was funny or not? I think of Vlada. Wonder what she was going through that night. Who had she thought she'd found in Jack? What did she think, walking away from his door? Did she remember him for long? And what of Jack in his own eyes? Did he see himself as a gleeful young pilot, ready to leap the oceans, explore jungles, continents away from South Orange? Or had he grown some armor he hadn't had before the war? A toughness about the heart that would recede and then strengthen again in the tough years to come. If Vlada could be dismissed with a laugh, how ready was he to open his heart seriously to any woman back home?